You may remember that this morning I described a situation as follows. I'm talking to you, and you understand what my words mean. Situation A. Situation B is, taking situation A as a whole, my talking to you and you understanding what I mean, what does that situation mean? And we find it doesn't mean anything. This could be a way, when we say something is meaningless, it's a way of putting it down. But on the other hand, when you consider a mountain or a cloud or a tree and ask what does it mean, and you realize it's not a word, it's simply an authentic existence in its own right, it doesn't mean anything, but it's great. And so in this way, the nearest thing in that kind of achievement that nature does all the time in human activities is music. Once when Gustav Holst was giving a lecture on music, he started out this way. He said, music is a natural and universal language. He took a step backwards and said, that's so important I'm going to say it again. Music is a natural and universal language. But nobody knows what it's about. Sometimes we say music represents emotions. But a great deal of music, although it has a very strong feeling quality, does not represent specific emotions. Inferior music copies natural noises, so that you hear the sound of water, the thunder of the hooves of horses, or in that dreadful composition, the 1812 overture of Tchaikovsky, you hear Napoleon's armies retreating from Moscow. Or in some of the bad work of Debussy, like La Cathédrale Engloutie, who makes noises like bells tolling from under the water. But our very great musicians of the West, Bach, Scarlatti, Mozart, and so on, they don't do anything with the music except create elaborate patterns of sound. Bach is very mathematical, and yet, curiously, despite his tremendously developed intellect, the music has a very strong feeling quality, joyous and exuberant. But it's all pure play with sound. And therefore one might say that the communication that you make with music is in a curious way the most important kind of communication you can make, even though you're saying nothing. The music delivers no information, but what a form of communication. And so it is also with dancing with somebody. All you are saying with dancing is, I love you, if you're delivering any message at all. I want to play with you. All I really want to do is, baby, be friends with you. What does it mean? What is the content of friendship? You can't say. What is the content of love? I want to screw you? That's a sort of, it's part of it, it's incidental, it's a way of saying very strongly, yes, I do want to be with you. But basically, love is something we can't put our finger on at all. We say, we use such words as warmth, tenderness, all these things, they don't really get to the point. When you're loving somebody, you are simply delighting in that person as such, as if another human organism, in its mental and its physical aspects, were a piece of music, or a work of art, or a glorious morning, that you were just enjoying every inch of it. and you go over another person's physical form and look at it from every possible point of view and play with it and tickle it. And that's what it's about. It's the adoration of the form of a human being. And you do that adoring in terms of physical contacts that are, say, dancing with your fingers across the skin, or whatever it may be. But this is the nitty-gritty, the nub of love. It is not that I here and now solemnly undertake to support you for the rest of your life. That's a delusion of the West. You think you don't really love me unless you will sign on the dotted line here and give me this contract. And then I know I can rely on you always. What did you want it for? Why did you want the contract? Just to be fed indefinitely? Just to be supported indefinitely? What a bore. One wants something much more than that. You want to be played with indefinitely. That's more like it. To have this vibrancy going through you. And this then is why music of all the arts is the most meaningless art. You could regard, as a matter of fact, we could scare the entire American public by writing up music as a form of dangerous addiction. After all, music is a major industry in the United States. The money invested in orchestras, in operas, in the recording business is fantastic. Horse racing is a very great industry, but music, I think, is probably absorbs more millions than horse racing. And you could make a case that this was a complete dissipation. It solves no useful purpose. It doesn't help anyone to survive. It is a noise. Meaningless noise, endless meaningless noise going down the drain. And all these energies of orchestras are all a power of electronics that delivers this. It's total waste. And people get hooked on it. They get a thing called chorditis, which is addiction to harmonics. And they have to have this repeated day after day. Some people get up in the morning and they can't function till they've had a cup of coffee. But many more people get up in the morning and can't function till they've turned on the radio and got some music. They are hopelessly hooked on a narcotic music. And what would you say then of a culture which took this standpoint? Music not allowed. Music is a diversion from reality. You can imagine this sort of state of mind going on in Red China or somewhere like that, where everybody has to be tremendously realistic and face facts and get up every morning and do exercises for your physical improvement. You know, that kind of awful utilitarian attitude. But really, one of the basic things, you see, that we live for, what makes it worth surviving and going on, is there can be such a thing as music. There can be dancing. In other words, that we can do things that are absolutely irrelevant so far as mere survival is concerned. Now, we have the proverb that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Dull for work. And people who play so that they shall be able to work better, justifying their play by making it a means to that end, those people never play. Because you don't really play until you get so absorbed in the music or the dancing or the whatever, the making the pot or doing the calligraphy, until you get so absorbed in it that there is no reason for it other than what you're doing. The sheer delight of that. Then, because you are absorbed in something for which there is no ulterior motive and which is pure play, this, by way of a byproduct, produces sanity. In other words, if you play in order to be healthy, in order to be sane, you are not playing. But if you play just to play, then as a byproduct, as something you couldn't aim at directly, you are sane. And so a culture which allows for this, which allows for this sort of goofing is a healthy culture. This is not the culture that we live in, very healthy, because it is extremely anxious about play. Everybody, when they play, they have to find an excuse for it. They say, well, this is culture. You try and persuade the city of San Francisco to support its opera. What sort of propaganda do you have to use? You can't say, we should have a good opera house here because we just like going to the opera. Say, this improves the city's image. After all, they have it in New York, and wouldn't you think that San Francisco at least could equal New York? I mean, it's a matter of prestige. And therefore, the city should support the opera. And then, finally, you get this terrible racket that all kinds of people belong on the committee, and it's a matter of social one-upmanship as to whether you get on the committee, how much money you contribute to it, and so on and so on. It has nothing to do with the symphony or the opera at all. And that is because we do not allow ourselves the idea that life is not serious. Because somehow you feel if you aren't engaged in something serious, you're a loafer. You're not contributing to the social welfare. And so in this way, the artist has a peculiar role in this society. Very, very interesting. Because the artist is a very deceptive fellow. He appears to be the supreme luxury, the irrelevant fellow. You can afford an artist. You can afford to buy paintings. If you have surplus money, that's a luxury. So you can support an artist, and we call it fine arts. The completely useless person who makes paintings, which are sort of big labels or posters that you stick on your utilitarian walls to decorate them, and as if to say, around here we can afford frippery. But on the other hand, the artist is the man who shows you the future long before everybody else sees it. The artist is the eye-opener. Just because the artist is distinct in role from the preacher and the philosopher, the artist can get away with all sorts of things. For example, in our culture, if you're a university professor, a doctor, or a minister, take these three professions, teacher, doctor, minister, you have to be very careful about your private life. Because the moment you have any alliances that are not quite regular, people's tongues begin to wag. And why do they wag? Because they say the way you behave is inconsistent with your profession, with what you profess. You are teaching people the good life, the healthy life, and you live in this disreputable way. You have a mistress, you have something or other going on. But the moment an artist should take a mistress, this is what is expected of him. Everybody says, oh, he's an artist. In other words, he doesn't matter. He's irrelevant. He's an entertainer, some sort of clown. But on the other hand, if you belong to high culture, you patronize artists. See? So the role of the artist is very fascinating, because he appears to be the clown, the jester, the absolutely unimportant and irrelevant person. And yet it's actually through the artist that we learn how to live, not through the preacher. not through the philosopher, not through the professor. It is the artist teaches us, whether he does it visually, with painting, or sculpture, tactually, or whether, above all, in music. So a man like Mozart, who could well claim to be the greatest man in European history, was a kind of a gay, happy-go-lucky fellow with problems, money, illness, etc. But what a songbird, what a nightingale. And so then to this day, listening to Mozart as in England, the Glyndebourne Opera, this is about the farthest out fashionable, aristocratic thing you can do. To go to this lovely country house in Sussex and hear the Mozart operas. It's as much a matter of status as going to church. Almost more so. You should read, if you can get hold of it, an interview with George Harrison, one of the Beatles, in a recent issue of the East Village Other, where he explains the deep philosophy of music that they understand and follow. How the very nature of sound reveals the meaning of the world. And why, because of this, he regards himself as a Hindu. In Hinduism, the fundamental source of life is called Vak. Vak in Sanskrit means the word, to speak. But not so much the word that communicates as the sound, the utterance, the flow of tone. So you have in India the use of mantra, the use of chanted words as one of the very basic forms of yoga, understanding the mystery of the world. The Hindus use the word Om, which would be spelled out A-U-M, because the letter A-R is in the back of the throat. You push it through the vowel to Aum, and M is at the lips. So the word Om comprehends the whole range of sound. It's called the prana. And Om simply means, well, it is the sound. All sounds are basically the sound Om, but varied. And so Om is the word that not only signifies, but also is what there is. Everything is Om. Om sweet Om. The whole universe is Om. And so this is a very good word, because you can use it instead of God. God has all sorts of nasty associations attached to it. The political boss of the world, the preacher, the prig, the nosy Parker in charge of everything, the rotten grandfather, and all that, the sentimental mother of the world, or whatever it is. And the word God, therefore, is a distasteful word now to most Westerners. But Om has no associations with it. You might have encountered it in a Vedanta society and associated with Swamis in yellow robes or something. But on the whole, Om has no association. And so it is a clean word, and it has no meaning, except it is the very pulse of life. And so I'm spreading a rumor. In Buddhism, you know, there is a mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And Om means nothing, except everything. Mani means a jewel. Padma is a lotus. Hung is hooray. You know? So the jewel and the lotus. In other words, imagine a mandala, you see, which is a lotus flower, with all those petals spreading out from it. And right bang in the middle of that, there is a little crystal ball, or a diamond. And you look into that, and it contains the reflection of everything. See? You go way, way, way into that thing, down, 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 you know? And that's the ultimate turn-on. So, Om, and at the end, Hum, or H-U-M. You can say Hum in English, Hum, Hum, you hum. Now, there's a new religion existing called Hum. And this religion has no hierarchy, no organization, no doctrines whatsoever. No words. Only music and ritual. And we will find in a little while that Hum is really what most people belong to. And but you can't pin it down. There is no address to write to. There's nothing to join. It's just something that people do, like they shave and brush their teeth and eat breakfast. So they hum. Well, now, it's very, very fascinating for purposes of understanding music as communication to look for a moment at different fundamental differences between Western and Oriental music. Many Westerners listen to Oriental music. They have funny reactions. I know a very, very great musicologist who thoroughly understands the world of Bach and Beethoven and is one of the greatest scholars in music I've ever run into. But when to his ear, Hindu music is childish. And he sees no subtlety in it. He's quite deaf. But when it comes to Chinese and Japanese music, most Westerners are flabbergasted. They can't make any sense of it at all, because it sounds as if somebody were making the most ridiculous noises. So when there's a Japanese no drama singer comes on, we think he's sounding as if he's being strangled. But he's giving sounds of passionate love. See? But to our ears, that's a deplorable. Can't do things like that and have people pay to come and listen. You know, when we want to give examples of love, etc., you know, and that feels that we really have said we're in love. Yeah. Now, talking of nightingales, do you know, this isn't, apart from the seminar, this is just a little piece of information. Mockingbirds in California can do half of the routine of a nightingale. And the reason is that Respighi's, the birds, has been played by people on their patios, and it has half of the routine of the nightingale in it, and the mockingbirds have picked it up. Yes, down in the south, yes. And I had an altercation with a mockingbird one night in Santa Barbara. It's very funny, you can whistle to them, and they will play back your whistle and do all sorts of funny things. They're wonderful to play with. But, well, you say, well, what's it all about? Well, now, here's the thing. In Western music, when we study music, the first thing we learn is notation. We have, most people begin with the piano, or at any rate some instrument, where the important thing is to be able to read the music and then do the stuff from the written paper. Now, this limits you in a curious way, because our notation, first of all, is based on the chromatic scale. And secondly, it has fixed rhythmic intervals. You have, you see, your whole note, half note, quarter note, eighth note, sixteenth note. And you can change the value of those notes by dotting them to give them half their value. And you tend to write in bars. 4-4 time, 3-8, or whatever it may be. And when an Oriental listens to our music, it doesn't matter whether it's a love song or a grandiose paean of praise or whatever. All of it sounds like a military march. Because it's that 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, or 1-2-3-4-5-6, 1-2-3-4-5-6, 1-2-3-4-5-6, here's a all the time. And he hears a mechanism in it. You see, he hears this absolute regularity. Now, in Indian music, you'll have bars, very long measure. You can count 20 to the bar, sometimes more. And when you learn music from an Hindu teacher, you don't learn notation. You learn directly from the teacher. In other words, he takes the instrument and plays it, and you copy him with the same instrument sitting in front of him. And they think, you see, that notation could never record music. They do use a notation. They use a notation to remember simply themes. There is a certain rag, a certain theme, and they can write that down. But they don't play from it. What they do is they, according to certain traditional procedures, they improvise on the basic forms, and you therefore play the instrument. And what you're trying to do is to make it as completely as possible responsive to the subtle motions of which a human organism is capable. In other words, just as in moving your hand, there's an infinity of waves you can put it through, so likewise in using your voice, there is an infinity of sound that you can produce. Because the same you can with a stringed instrument, in moving your finger, where there are no rigid stops as there would be on a piano. So on the continuum of a violin, you can move your finger and produce an infinity of subtle sound. And what they do is they delight in the infinite possibility of making sound with the human organism, and they like instruments which are very easily and directly related to the organism. So the flute, the veena, the drums. See, these are direct human contact with an instrument. With a piano, you've got something interspersed. You've got a hammer mechanism and a rigidly tuned string. With a harpsichord, the same way, the pluck. And when Wanda Landowska, marvelous as she is, plays the harpsichord, you get a hurdy-gurdy effect. Clickety-clickety-click, clop-clop-clop-clop, clickety-click, clop-clop, chickety-chick-chick-chick, clop-clop, clickety-click-click-click-click. You hear this going on all the time. And clavichord, there is a difference, because the clavichord doesn't have a mechanical relationship between the finger and the string. It is a continuous bar, so that by every variation of touch you make on a clavichord is represented in the sound. In other words, the piano and the harpsichord are like electric typewriters, which have a uniform touch, whereas the clavichord is more like an old-fashioned typewriter, where however hard you hit has some effect on the print. So, in Oriental music, then, while there is an incredibly subtle discipline, and a Hindu drummer can do the most astounding things, and you can count it out, he counts it out in these very, very elaborate patterns. But at the same time, there is an attitude about it that's just fascinating. We attended a concert at the De Young Museum a few weeks ago, where there was Ali Akbar Khan's orchestra.
And there was a drummer in this who was just out of this world. And the wonderful thing about it was that as he was playing with the rest of the orchestra, they were all talking to each other with their instruments. And they made eye contact while they were playing. And this guy was just in sheer delight. He was laughing as he was playing. And all the other musicians were just loving it, coming on with it, you see. So that he wasn't this dead, earnest person looking at his music, you know, and reading that and doing it. He was joining in with everybody, dancing with them. His fingers were like butterflies, hummingbirds, better to say, just vibrating in the most extraordinary way. Because it takes years and years and years to learn this. But he was really enjoying it. But what was he saying? They have a language for the drums, and they can speak a drum rhythm by using syllables like dit, di, dit, da, dit, di, dit, da, or din, meaning one kind of a hit, and thin, din and thin, din, thin, din, thin, din, thin, din, thin, din, dit, di, dit, da, dit, di, dit, da, dit, da, 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 you know, and they explain a rhythm like this sometimes first. They say it, and then they play it. But it's all, what's all about? It's all about dit-da. Dit-da. I suppose some of you have read a book of mine called The Joyous Cosmology, in which I referred to once a very curious experience I had with Hindu music. I happen to have acquired from Timothy Leary some of this extraordinary Mexican mushroom, and I was feeling awful. I'd come back from a trip to the East and was tired, and I had a sore throat and was just lousy. So I took this thing, and at the first it just felt just terrible. Everything turned into mud. You know what you expect of mushrooms, of fungus, everything fungoid and kind of clammy and dark. Well, after a while it all changed. And I found myself listening to this Hindu music. I didn't know what it was, because my host, whose house I was at, didn't explain anything. And I thought, when I listened to this, what kind of idiocy is going on? I thought, you see, my friend with whom I was spending the day is a pretty wild kind of fellow. And I thought he had put on a tape recording of his and his friend's antics, because they weren't doing anything that anybody's supposed to do. It was like children making faces. You know how they look good, these kind of things that children love to do. Something, these awful faces, and make weird noises. I thought, this is just something absolutely absurd going on. And then came this dit-da business in the middle of it. So I said, Roger, hey, let me see the album. And I got the case, and here it says, Classical Music of India, edited by Anand Danielu, who is the most scholarly, respectable pundit on the subject of Hindu music. I said, somebody's pulling my leg. No, not at all. Here was this just babbling sound. Not only do the dit-da business, but they also could use their voices like oboes. You know how you could put a clothespin on your nose and do an oboe stunt. And it sounded like this, and it was just this whole kind of business of children just going out of their heads. Well, I listened to this, and I suddenly realized that that's what life's all about. And, you know, it was the most fantastic, sudden recognition that everything in this world is gloriously meaningless. And there's curlicues, like on ferns. We get mixed up about it because sometimes we think that a play that is going on. Look, when you see a fern, it has, first of all, the main branch. Then it has sub-branches. And out of these sub-branches come sub-sub-branches. And out of the sub-sub-branches come sub-sub-sub-branches. And so you get a fern. So now you could number each of these levels on which things are happening. And you say, well, this is a number 1 level, this is a number 42 level, this is a number 65 level. And you judge events and say, it's good, it's bad, it's proper, it's improper. But what you don't recognize is that you say something is improper because you thought it was a 63 level, whereas really it was 112. And you didn't know, you didn't realize the level the thing was on. So actually, the whole play of human life, with all its joys and sorrows, its tragedies, its evils, its good, is just something like a fern. And a fern has diseases on it, it has tumors on it. That means just simply another clan is making its life there. See, a clan of bugs of some kind are living there too. And they're doing their stuff. They're living off the fern's living off something else. We're all leaning on each other in one way or another. And I saw this whole thing as this fantastic play. So, in order to get into the... Can you get into that state, you see? You get into it by listening to sound. That's one way in. There are lots of ways in. But one of the easiest ways in is through concentration on a tone. Because, you see, this is the easiest way to stop thinking for most people. If you just concentrate on a single sound, it's very easy to do it. You just ride with that sound, and this stops your thoughts. In other words, it stops you talking to yourself inside your head, verbalizing. And the important thing is, if you want the vision of the world as it really is, you have to stop talking, at least temporarily. It doesn't mean that talking is a bad thing. It means it's too much of a good thing. So that if you silence talking, and you experience yourself just in the same way as you experience that's what's going on. And it may be going on, you know, in a kind of a way that you call nice, which is no, it may be going on that way. But so what? Finally, it is that. That's what's happening. And we're all taught by our mothers and fathers to put a value on it. See, when it goes a certain way, the rhythm of life goes in a certain way when we say, oh, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out, because that may be the end. What will the end be? Plunk. What's wrong with that? Things that start have to stop. Things that go on have to go off, and things that go off have to go on. But you see, we get involved by putting a value on it all. Right, now I could say that's bad, you shouldn't do it, but at the same time, getting involved and putting values on it's all part of the game too. Getting hung up, getting hooked. So you don't get unhooked by saying to yourself, I shouldn't be attached. I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. All you do is you see that getting hooked on it is simply another form of it. More nonsense. More jazz. But deeper jazz. So, like you feel you have an ego, that's an illusion. But it's a very weird illusion. See? It's a very far out scene. A person who you might call a square, who's thoroughly committed to the illusions of standard life, is a very far out person because he doesn't know where he started. He's completely lost. But you could say it's a great show. to get that far out, to get that involved in seriousness. So when you look at a square who has this determined, set, inflexible attitude, you have to say secretly, you laugh and say, "My, you're doing a wonderful job. How far out could you get?" So you can learn in this way to love squares. And this is the only way that will ever change anything. You must never condemn the squares with harsh language, because they are very far out people, but they don't know it. Involved, in other words, in the ultimate curlicues. It's like a labyrinth. You see, all life is a labyrinth. It's a system of tubes. And there are tubes within tubes within tubes. And upon the very, very great fringes of this labyrinth, you get all kinds of hothouse growths. Very complicated games. So complicated that the people involved in them are lost. But that's simply a function of being a long way from the center. When a fern or any form of plant expands from its center, what is happening is this. Inside the stems and the stalks and the tubes which constitute this organism, they're all little creatures. And they're going, traveling along. And they're getting out there. They want to go out. Of course, there's always somebody along with them who says, "Now be careful. Don't you get too far out, because if you get too far out, you spoil the form. Instead of keeping inside the bounds of the fern, you'll just go off into gas. And that would be awful." See, because you're a fern, you're not gas. But those little creatures out in the end say, "Man, we'd like a gas." No? So they want to get way off. But there's something there that says, "Keep back, keep back, keep back, keep it in, keep it in, keep it in." But it is a result of the tension between those little fellows that want to go way out, see, and the people who want to stay in, that you get the outline. The clear form of leaf. They're working against each other. But they are working, even though the one thinks it's right and the other thinks it's right. They're both right and they're both wrong. They're both right and wrong. But they do by being both in a counter position like this, they create what we call existence. What we call the shape of the leaf, the form of the fern. So, you will find, of course, that some of them are, in fact, escaping. And some of them are going off into gas. And some of them are not. Some of them are staying put. And if there weren't some of them going off into gas, there would be no energy in the thing. You see, all energy is a quality of follow-through. When you hit a golf ball, you mustn't stop the hit at the ball. You have to go like that, see? Right through. So all energies of life have in them a possibility of an excess, of going too far. When you bring up your children and you tell your children your various far-out ideas, and the children suddenly believe in them, I'm horrified. No, all kinds of philosophy I've talked about is being believed by children, and they're taking it literally. I think, "Oh my God, what will they do next?" But everybody feels that way in regard to the strength of a younger generation that is coming on. Because this younger generation has energy. See, we think about young people. We have terrible ideas. We think that we know what life is, and that they have to be told, and that they will learn it from us and be like us. We don't take that attitude when we see the new vegetables come up in the spring. We don't say the vegetables have to be educated to be vegetables. We say, "Hooray, at last, young vegetables with all the life and energy in them. New meals for everything." So when we see young people come up, say, "Good gracious, isn't this great to see the human race is still doing its stuff. I wonder what they'll have to teach us." Because wisdom doesn't come from above down. It comes from below up. It's where the wisdom is. Surging into it. The old people, they have a function. But they have it, in order to fulfill that function, they have to understand first that they can learn from the young sources. If they understand that, then they can be wise and be teachers. If they don't understand that, they never can. To be wise, you have to... That's the meaning of saying that to enter the kingdom of heaven, you have to become again as a child. And finally, to get back to my point, to become as a child means that you do things which adults consider unimportant. There is a wonderful Buddhist character. His name is Hotei in Japanese, Putai in Chinese. He looks like this. And he carries around a bag, enormous bag, in which he collects rubbish, every kind of inconsequential rubbish, and gives it away to children, because children understand the meaning and significance of rubbish. Something which my father, when I was a small boy, once said, "You are a picker-up of unconsidered trifles." Because the rubbish is the most wonderful thing in the world from the point of view of a child. So once a Zen master was asked, "What is the most valuable thing in the world?" And he answered, "The head of a dead cat." Why? Because no one can put a price on it. So in this man, you see, who is wandering around picking up rubbish, all the trivialities of life, who sees leaves floating down in the wind and laughs at them, this is becoming again as the child. In other words, from the child's point of view, the things which the adult considers irrelevant to survival are perfectly important. And so children collect pebbles and colored glass and all sorts of trivia which they consider as precious as diamonds. The adults say, "Oh, frippery." But they really have the secret, you see. Now, the child, as child, doesn't know how to play the adult's game, which is a power game, and so has to be educated to learn the values of the power game, to learn what's what and what is important. But when he has mastered that game, he realizes it has no rewards. That all the things that the adults thought they were gaining by their power game are, after all, not worth having. That's why you can be rich and miserable. So that having learned and having seen through the adult power game, you come back to the point of the child. And so you say, well, let's have a brief intermission. We'll serve refreshments after seminar. Just the stress for a minute.
Yeah.